تمتطيه قوس قزح طفلة.
Good morning, everyone,
and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast where we feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice from a perspective that is all too often missing from the mainstream media. This is your host, John Roberts. We have an extended feature presentation this morning, so we'll get right to it. Max Blumenthal, author and journalist, was best known for his seminal work exposing and exploding the Zionist myths which drive our politics in this country, sits down with progressive radio host Tom Hartman to talk about his extensive experiences in Israel, the West Bank, and Gaza. Here are Max Blumenthal and Tom Hartman in conversation.
Hello, I'm Tom Hartman in Washington, D.C., and tonight we talk to one man for the hour, journalist and author Max Blumenthal, in a special edition of Conversations with Great Minds. My guest for tonight's Conversations with Great Minds is award-winning journalist and author Max Blumenthal. Currently a senior writer at Alternet and a former fellow at the Nation Institute, Max is one of the leading American journalists covering the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. He's reported on the ground from war-torn Gaza and has written a series of best-selling books on the topic, including his latest, The 51-Day War, Ruin and Resistance in Gaza, a must-read account of a 2014 conflict that destroyed 10,000 homes, killed 2,200 people, and displaced 300,000 other human beings. Max Blumenthal, welcome.
Good to be with you.
Good to have you with us. I'd like to start out with just kind of Middle East politics 101, if we could, because there's you know, so much language flying around, and people, there are assumptions made that particularly the average American understands, oh, this is what Hamas is, or Hamas, you know, if the Israeli pronunciation. Yeah, right. Or this is Hezbollah, or what. Yeah, let's talk about who the players are and how this situation got to where it is. And maybe for that, we have to dial all the way back to the 1950s and blowing up the King David Hotel. And, you know, I don't know where you want to start the story, but can you set the stage for us about how the Middle East got to where it is right now?
No, I actually can't explain a macro view of how the Middle East got to where it is today. But if you look at the catastrophe the catastrophes that are filling the pages of newspapers daily, just look at the image of Aylan Kurdi, the little boy who washed up on the shore, which is, you know, this broadcast will air later, but this is what everyone's talking about right now, the migrant crisis. Like, tens of thousands of migrants are marching now from Budapest to Austria. There's upheaval in Europe. You can't look at this without looking at the legacy of colonialism, the great game in the Middle East, and the legacy of Zionist settler colonialism in historic Palestine. I mean, these are two of the major events, historical events, that destabilized the Middle East and set the stage for where we are today. Of course, so many things happened along the line. Arab autocracy and oppression is a major factor, internal repression. But you can't look at this. You can't look at what's happening now. Of course, climate change is a factor, but you can't look at it outside of Sykes-Picot, outside of the great game that the great powers played, and outside of the foundation of the State of Israel.
So let's take those one at a time. What is the great game?
The great game was when the four great powers started slicing up the Middle East and creating these fake countries.
This is post-World War I.
Yeah. And so Sykes-Picot established what are the modern borders of the Middle East. And, you know, for example, the Hashemites were supporters of British imperialism in Iraq, and they were given Jordan, which is basically a fake state that's controlled by the Hashemites, which is mostly Palestinian. And they rule through authoritarian means. Syria was created in a similar fashion. And dictatorships emerged through the era of Arab nationalism in order to in the post-colonial era, and actually wound up reinforcing these borders. And now you have the emergence of groups like Islamic State, who are actually appealing to the long-standing resentment among Arabs across the Middle East about Sykes-Picot and about these borders, and about not being able to travel from one Arab state to another. And the Islamic State is basically saying, we're going to create a giant caliphate with no borders. And so on a local level, this has appealed to a lot of people who previously couldn't enter Syria from Iraq. Obviously, Islamic State is the most barbaric group currently operating in the Middle East, but there are real resentments that they're appealing to.
And part of that has to do with the creation of the State of Israel and the evolution of the State of Israel.
Well, there used to be a railroad in Gaza. There used to be taxi services that would go from Jerusalem to Haifa in northern, what is now northern Israel, to Damascus, to Beirut. If you were a Palestinian prior to the foundation of the State of Israel, or if you were a Jew living there prior to the foundation of this ethnically exclusive self-proclaimed Jewish state, you could have breakfast in Jerusalem, lunch in Damascus, and dinner in Beirut. Today, that is impossible. And if you are a Palestinian citizen of the State of Israel, 20% of Israel of Israeli citizens are Palestinian Arabs, you will face criminal sanctions if you attempt to travel to Syria or Lebanon without the permission or knowledge of the government.
Some of the major players in the region, I mentioned Hamas and Hezbollah. Can you tell us who these groups are and how they came about and what their agenda is right now?
Well, Hamas currently controls the Gaza Strip. It was elected in Palestinian legislative elections in 2006, which were authorized by the U.S. and the Bush administration as part of its democracy promotion initiative in the Middle East, and also because they saw Hamas as an Islamist force that would help isolate Islamic extremist groups like Al-Qaeda, which is correct. Hamas has always been kind of opposed to these groups. And so Hamas won in those elections. Their legislators were kidnapped, and they managed to secure power through a civil conflict with Fatah, their rival, in the Gaza Strip. Hamas is portrayed as a terrorist group in the West. United States has an official policy of not negotiating with Hamas, even as it negotiates with the Taliban, even as David Petraeus, former central commander of U.S. forces, declares that Al-Qaeda is now a possible asset for the U.S. and the Middle East. But who is Hamas? Hamas emerged from the Muslim Brotherhood for many years. Throughout the 70s and even the 80s, it had what was known as a quietist policy towards Israel, in which its leadership focused more on zakat, charity, and building up a capacity at the grassroots level in places like the poorest refugee camps in the Gaza Strip, rather than confronting Israel. Israel gave it a free hand to do so because this helped isolate the PLO, which was a more secular resistance group.
And Arafat's group.
Exactly. And, you know, during the 90s, Hamas emerged as what it described as an Islamic resistance group through its military armed wing, the Al-Qassam Brigades. And this is when it became involved in armed confrontation with Israel. These initially took the form of attacks mostly on soft Israeli targets, including suicide bombings against buses, restaurants, etc., that were initiated in 1994 after a fanatical settler from Brooklyn, a Jewish settler from Brooklyn, Brooke Goldstein, massacred 29 Palestinian worshippers at the Ibrahimi Mosque in Hebron. So this was a response. Hamas's military wing didn't have the military capacity to challenge Israeli soldiers and troops directly. So the suicide bombing, the attack on soft targets, was sort of their weapon of choice. It was also a psychological weapon aimed at tormenting Israeli society, applying a price tag to Israeli attacks on Palestinian civilians. At the same time, Hamas's leadership and al-Qassam's leadership, they were led by a guy named Yahya Ayash at this time, was capable of abiding by truces. And during a ceasefire, Ayash was assassinated. The Israelis had arranged through a Palestinian collaborator to hand him a cell phone that contained an explosive charge. It was detonated remotely by a helicopter, and it blew half of his head off. And this led to, and this was authorized by Shimon Peres, who's the Israeli Labor Party grand old man, who is seen as kind of a dovish leader, a peacenik even. He has a center for peace in Israel. He initiated this assassination, and it led to another wave of suicide bombings. So this, what we think of as a cycle, continued, but it was actually sort of a provocation. As the Second Intifada persisted in the early, from 2000 to 2005, suicide bombings began to wane. In 2005, Israel initiated what's known as the disengagement from the Gaza Strip, when it pulled out 9,000 fanatical settlers, and basically sealed off the Gaza Strip, laid siege to it, and began occupying it through the panopticon model of electrified fences, remote-controlled machine guns on concrete walls, a naval siege preventing Gaza's fishing fleets from going more than 3 miles at sea. Drones are now overhead 24 hours a day in the Gaza Strip, weaponized drones, and most people are unable to leave. And so when this happened, the Al-Qassam brigades actually initiated a parallel strategy of militarization. They said, you know, the suicide bombing hasn't succeeded. It's been a moral catastrophe. It's been a PR catastrophe. But now we have the ability, through our tunnel network in the south of the Gaza Strip, which abuts the Sinai Peninsula, to import better weapons and become a sophisticated guerrilla force and challenge Israel directly. So I tell this story in my book, The 51-Day War, of how Gaza militarized. The Al-Qassam brigades emulated the model of Hezbollah. And in this war that my book describes, it was a war, it wasn't just an assault by Israel, the Al-Qassam brigades actually confronted Israeli military personnel directly, targeted the military almost exclusively in ground combat, and managed to kill a substantial number of Israeli soldiers. Of the 75 Israeli citizens who were killed in last summer's attack on Gaza, 68 were armed combat soldiers, which tells you something about Hamas and the Al-Qassam Brigade's strategy, and should really raise questions about the labeling of this group as a terrorist group. It has no longer is demonstrating an intention to attack soft Israeli targets or to terrorize the civilian population.
You're suggesting basically that they're an army for an organization, a government that was actually democratically elected in Gaza. But we'll continue this in just a moment. More of tonight's Conversations with Great Minds with Max Blumenthal right after this break. Welcome back to Conversations with Great Minds. I'm speaking with journalist and writer Max Blumenthal, author of the new book, The 51-Day War, Ruin and Resistance in Gaza. Max, we were talking about Hamas and the role that they play in Gaza. I want to continue that, but I noticed in the newspaper the other day that your dad had sent some. This is when the Republicans were forcing Hillary to reveal her emails, that your dad had been forwarding some of your articles about the conflicts in Israel to her, and she was responding. Are you an informal advisor to Hillary Clinton?
I met her once for about 2 minutes when I was 16, and that's the extent of my personal contact with her. She seemed like a nice lady. I haven't spoken to her since then, and I actually wasn't aware about the content of these emails or that this was taking place, but it's not surprising. And he was forwarding her accurate information, forwarding her articles from Haaretz. His assessments have been completely vindicated by Netanyahu's behavior. His assessments were very critical of Netanyahu, and they've been vindicated. He forwarded her a survey I wrote on the growing international network of Islamophobia, which is this transatlantic right-wing network. It was the first real, one of the first long reports written on this network in on U.S. media, and that's been completely vindicated with the rise of the far right in the EU and these rallies outside mosques in the U.S. So, and what he forwarded her that I had written about the attack on the Free Gaza flotilla was completely accurate. So he was providing her with accurate information. But beyond that, I think what this shows is not something that's unique to my father or to me. It's something that's happening in Washington and that's been happening, which is that Israel is not spoken about in favorable terms in private quarters among the Washington establishment, particularly within the Democratic Party. AIPAC rules through fear, through intimidation, and through financial enticement. It doesn't have a solid actual base in Washington of hardcore supporters. There's currently not enough of an opposition.
Outside of the evangelical community, perhaps?
That's what the Israel lobby calls its safety belt and the Bible Belt, and that's its only grassroots base. I mean, you go out in the Bible Belt, and you'll see a bunch of guys driving around in pickup trucks that have NRA stickers. You don't see people driving around anywhere in America with AIPAC stickers on their car. It's a completely top-heavy lobby, and that's the fear. That's why there's been so much hysteria in neoconservative media about the emails my father sent to Hillary and about the fact that some of my articles, which were completely accurate and have all been vindicated, were sent to her. Obviously, Hillary is going to listen to someone like her mega donor, Haim Saban, who said, "I'm a one-issue guy and my issue is Israel," more than she's going to listen to my assessments. They don't seem to have had any impact on her. But the fear among neoconservatives who increasingly dominate AIPAC, the front line of the Israel lobby, is that these discussions are happening. And I know they're happening because I know people in Washington. I grew up here. My book party that my parents hosted for me for my second book, Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel, at their home, was reported as a scandal by the Washington Free Beacon, this Sheldon Adelson, Paul Singer-funded neocon Potemkin village operation. Mm. And I can understand why they were afraid, because many State Department officials were there. Many progressive operatives in Washington were there. People who have influence in Washington were there to listen to me. And when I spoke to that room, and I spoke of AIPAC in a critical way, in a harshly critical way, they cheered, because they hate AIPAC here. Wow. And with good reason. With good reason. I mean, if you believe in American empire, like you're David Petraeus, you're going to see AIPAC as an obstacle, just as if you believe in basic human rights and fairness like me. Mm-hmm. So AIPAC has set itself up. I think of the scene in The Wizard of Oz when the Wicked Witch finally is put to rest, and all the little people come out to dance. That's what's happening with the passage of the Iran deal, and that's what's going to happen when AIPAC is finally vanquished.
Vanquished?
There's no question. I mean, you're starting to see bipartisan support erode.
How would you characterize the modern Israeli state?
The modern Israeli state?
I mean, AIPAC is one of their most visible faces here in the United States.
The fact that AIPAC is lobbying against the Iran deal almost entirely within the Republican Party is a reflection of what the modern Israeli state has become. It's become comprehensively right-wing with a Jewish Israeli population, especially the younger population that is consumed with eliminationist racism against Palestinians. It is is consistently ranked as the most militarized society in the world. It's a high-tech garrison state that is more increasingly religious, and among religious Jewish Israelis, fascistic opinions are common. You look at the Israeli Democracy Index, these polls by the IDI, the Israeli Democracy Institute, and it shows that young Israelis, by a majority, would refuse to sit in a classroom with an Arab, would refuse to live next door to an Arab. And the more that separation takes hold through the separation wall in the West Bank, through the siege of Gaza, and Palestinians disappear from Israeli society, the more these opinions become prevalent. Beyond that, you have a movement in the West Bank among the religious nationalist settler movement to create something that is like a Jewish version of ISIS. And these, this blueprint has been laid out by Meir Ettinger, who is the grandson of Rabbi Meir Kahana, who actually proposed in the 1980s a state of Judea, which would be a religious fascist state entirely ethnically pure, free of Palestinians, from the river to the sea, which would, of course, require mass ethnic cleansing. It would be a Jewish version of ISIS. And Ettinger, in a series of blog posts, has spelled out how this will be implemented. And his group in the West Bank has been linked to the firebombing of Palestinian homes, including the Dawabsha family in Douma near Nablus, where a little infant boy was burned to death, Ali Dawabsha. So this plan that they're trying to implement, they're doing so through terror. They claim to be taking on the Israeli army, but if you're out in the West Bank, you can see that they operate almost under the protection of the Israeli army. And beyond that, 40 to 50% of the Israeli army's officer corps are religious nationalist messianists who are sympathetic to this kind of perspective. So the state of Israel is in a transitional phase. It has been since the collapse of the peace process in 2000, and we're starting to see its culmination. It's what I explain in my book, Goliath, that Israel is in a permanent right-wing reality. And these governments that have been led by Benjamin Netanyahu will increasingly take a far-right character. Netanyahu is actually at the hollow center of Israeli politics, although he's seen as a man of the right. The people that he's catering to in his governing coalition are well to his right, like the Justice Minister Ayelet Shaked, who said that Palestinian mothers should be exterminated because their children are, in her words, little snakes. Netanyahu will cater to that. Just this week, the expression of opinions on Israeli news broadcasts was outlawed. The Israeli government aims to restrict donations to human rights NGOs based in Israel. Ofer Akunis, who is a close ally of Benjamin Netanyahu, said that Joseph McCarthy was right in everything he said. And the McCarthyite atmosphere in Israel, in which anyone who takes a dissident opinion is driven out of public life. I mean, we've seen school principals and teachers in Israel being hounded for expressing opinions against the occupation, is transferring to the American environment. And the Israel lobby, as it reflects the right-wing character of the Israeli government, will embrace a new McCarthyism and attempt to impose its regime of intimidation and fear on anyone in American academia, in American politics, in American public life who diverges from the position of the Likud government. We saw that attempted most recently with with Stephen Salaita, the academic at the University of Illinois, professor of Native American studies, who was stripped of his job for tweets he published critical of Israel's assault on Gaza last summer. And we're seeing it on campus after campus. We're seeing it in legislation that aims to bar American companies from refusing to do business inside Israel. And Sheldon Adelson, one of the key donors of the Republican Party, and Haim Saban, one of the top 10 donors to the Democratic Party, close friend of the Clintons, have both ponied up tens of millions of dollars, maybe $100 million, to fight the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement on campus. So it's going to get ugly. Mm. And that's a reflection of what Israel is today. What I'm saying is that we don't know where Israel's borders are. We know where it starts, but we don't know where it ends. And it affects us too here. The special relationship with Israel is corroding whatever's left of American democracy.
Yeah. Countries tend to go right wing when they're under stress.
Yeah.
I mean, it's almost a cliche. And typically, hard right governments eventually lead to the disintegration of the state or to revolt.
Is there an analogy to be made here between what's going on in Israel right now and what happened in, for example, South Africa and in the year or three or five before that big transition in South Africa? Or are these completely unrelated?
Well, Pik Botha was one of the most right-wing leaders the South African apartheid regime ever had, and it was because of rising pressure.
That's my point.
But ultimately, he was replaced by de Klerk, and that's what I think the BDS movement, the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions movement, aims to do with Israel. I think Israel's sort of in the Botha era.
Mm-hmm.
But you constantly hear these calls for a Palestinian Gandhi, and though we know that the Palestinian Gandhi is in a graveyard somewhere in Nablus, the Palestinian Gandhi is locked in an Israeli jail on a hunger strike, the Palestinian Gandhi is under too much pressure and stress and systematic violence to be able to make a difference from within. So the question is, where is the Israeli de Klerk? And that's what I would hope to see in the next phase. But that requires more momentum from BDS, and it requires the mainstreaming of BDS in the American political system.
We'll get into that in just a moment. More of tonight's Conversations at the Great Minds with Max Blumenthal right after the break. Welcome back to Conversations with Great Minds. I'm speaking with journalist and writer Max Blumenthal, author of the new book, The 51-Day War, Ruin and Resistance in Gaza. Max, you mentioned in the last segment the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions movement, the BDS movement. What is this? Where did it come from? What's going on with it, and why has it got Israel freaked out?
The BDS movement is based on the Boycott movement that contributed to the unraveling of the apartheid regime in South Africa and enabled South Africa to become a multiracial democratic state. And it embraces those goals in Israel-Palestine. And those goals couldn't be more urgent than at a time when the Israeli government and the state of Israel, which control all territory between the river and the sea through a matrix of domination, has scrapped the peace process and is intent on maintaining the occupation indefinitely. So I'm a supporter of the BDS movement because I think it's the only means of establishing external pressure and increasing it in order to produce an actual change on the ground. The BDS call was issued in 2005 after Israel built the separation wall in the West Bank, separating occupied East Jerusalem from the West Bank, cutting Palestinian villages off from themselves. The International Court of Justice ruled that wall illegal. And then the Palestinian Authority, which is basically an arm of the occupation or a subcontractor of the occupation, did absolutely nothing. And so all of these civil society groups from among Palestinian refugees, Palestinian women's groups, really that represented kind of a consensus of Palestinian opinion came together and said, we need an enforcement mechanism to enforce international law in Israel-Palestine. That's what the BDS call is based on. So there are three UN resolutions that BDS aims to enforce. The first one is Resolution 181, which Israel claims that it accepted the supposed partition plan, but which it never embraced because it calls for Palestinians inside Israel to be provided with equal rights. So equal rights for Palestinian citizens of Israel, which they currently don't have, and I can talk for the next hour about the apartheid conditions they face. The second one is Resolution 194, which ratifies the Palestinian right of return.
There are, UN resolution.
It's a UN resolution, and it was passed in 1949. Israel actually accepted it as a condition for its own acceptance to the UN General Assembly, and it has denied refugees any right to return to their homes and property that were expropriated inside Israel. And then the third one is Resolution 242, and this was issued after Israel took control of what are now known as the Palestinian Occupied Territories in 1967, and it calls for an end to the occupation. These are all things that I think any fair-minded person can accept, but they're things that Israel and its supporters describe as tantamount to the destruction of the state of Israel.
Well, what do you say to people who would say, okay, Israel's this Jewish state and that was you know, the land was basically taken from the Palestinians in the 40s, and has been incrementally, you know, that's been increasing over time. And so you've got a bunch of really pissed off Palestinians, and not just the Palestinians, a lot of Arabs around them also. And, you know, if you were to succeed with the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, and Israel was to say, okay, fine, we're going to become a pluralistic society, we're going to, you know, acknowledge everybody, and Jews are no longer a majority in Israel, there are those who suggest that the Palestinians and many of the other Arab countries and citizens around there would say, okay, time for revenge. We're just going to wipe them out.
Well, those are the kind of existential fears that animate the ruthlessness of Israeli society and the army that represents it. The fear that if they give up one inch, they'll be thrown into the sea, while fishermen in Gaza are not allowed to enter the sea.
Right, but isn't there some legitimacy to those fears?
I mean, there's always a legitimacy to a fear. If you're the bully and you have blood on your hands, every bully is terrified that he or she will face terrible retribution once they give up their power. And I think there needs to be international intervention and a reconciliation process to prevent that from happening. I mean, just from my time in Palestinian society, I've spent extensive time there, I don't hear the kind of opinions that Jewish Israelis fear. I don't hear them in Gaza. People just kind of, in Palestinian society, the average person, they just want to be left alone. And they're being harassed and abused constantly, if not killed. So the source of the crisis is this ethnocratic state that you described. It's not because it's Jewish. If the Chinese had come and set up an ethnocratic state, there would be Sinophobic opinions among Palestinian society. And so when Israel becomes a democracy and incorporates Palestinians into its institutions as equals, those opinions weaken and dissipate. So that's what we're trying to get to. But you're right, it will be an Arab majority state,
which means it's no longer Israel.
Right? It could be Israel. It could be Israel Palestine. It could be anything. It doesn't have to not be Israel. It doesn't have to give up the Jewish connection to Jerusalem. What it has to give up is the exclusivism and the racist institutions and structure. And if that's, and I think there's no excuse for holding millions of people hostage, for warehousing people in Gaza, for excluding millions of people in squalid camps throughout the world, just so you can maintain what Ehud Barak, the former Israeli prime minister and defense minister, called a villa in the jungle, or what Theodor Herzl, the sort of intellectual godfather of Zionism, called a rampart against barbarism. The idea that you can establish a European outpost in the heart of the Middle East through force and violent demographic engineering is just fanciful, and it's what the source of the crisis is. So we have to move towards some kind of democratic reality to end the crisis. Now, there was recently a New Yorker article that I read about Donald Trump's supporters. It was written by someone who was profiling white nationalist leaders. And I've written extensively about white nationalism as well. And one of them was Jared Taylor. Jared Taylor is the leader of a group called American Renaissance. He believes that white people in the U.S. should establish an ethnically exclusive state of their own and be able to exclude others from it. And he says this isn't racist, it's just reality. And his fear is the demographic shifting of the U.S. And it's a fear that's been expressed by Donald Trump.
And why Pat Buchanan wrote a book about it.
And Pat Buchanan wrote The Death of the West, which is actually originally going to be called The Death of Whitey, until his white nationalist friend Sam Francis told him to change the title. And this is like, that book has influenced so many conservatives towards a white nationalist perspective. But in any case, what Jared Taylor was saying about the demographic shift in the U.S. and the fear of having a brown majority country is seen as anathema among almost all Americans except those within the far right. And these, you know, and it was obvious that the author of this piece was linking these opinions to Trump in order to show how extreme Trump is. But these opinions in Israel, that's the basis of the Jewish state. That is the basis of the maintenance of Israel in its current state. As an ethnocratic state, as an ethnocratic state that manipulates demographics, all of its policies are based on demographic engineering in order to keep the ethnic outcast, who happen to be the indigenous population, excluded, ghettoized, warehoused, or dispersed throughout the world. So it's unacceptable in the U.S., but we are the main supporters of it. And you and I and any liberal-minded person would be disgusted to hear another white person complain that black neighbors are moving into their neighborhood. But that is the basis of Zionism in its current phase.
Is keep the Arabs out. Keep.
This is for our ethno-religious group and nobody else. The goal is to maintain ethnically pure state.
But the United States, well, actually, I think you could probably make an argument that, and you and I talked about this last time we talked, that the United States in many ways was created as an ethnically pure state. It was even, you know, Catholics and Jews need not apply. It was just white, not just white and male, but Protestant as well. And that's obviously what the Pat Buchanan crowd wants to hang on to. But
well, that's what they want to go back to. They always talk about taking back America.
Yeah,
that's like the essence of the Trump campaign. And
right.
That's, you know,
this is happening. I get it that it's absolutely racist, and it's happening all over the world. I mean, we're seeing in Northern European democracies the emergence of these right-wing parties, and you know, Le Pen in France is probably one of the best known ones, in large part because of her father and whatnot. But you know, where they're saying, you know, our country is for our people, you know, Sweden for Swedes, Denmark for Danes, you know, why are we letting Syrians in here? Is that, how does a democracy make a transition? How does a democracy or a country maintain an identity as the nature of their people, their religion, their cultures change?
Well, you know, when you look at these far-right parties in Europe, part of their appeal is to a kind of a nostalgia for a past that never was, and a mythology for what European civilization has been. And Europe has never been civilized. I say that as a Jew. Any Jew should know that Europe was never civilized. And they're responsible for possibly the most appalling genocide in history. And this emerged from European nationalism. So the reemergence of European nationalism should be immediately rejected, along with its appeals to European and Western civilization. I'm with Gandhi. Western civilization, it would be a good idea. So you have a crisis in Europe, where Europe and the West has been involved, if not involved, has orchestrated the destabilization of the Middle East, and now refugees are washing up on its shores. Mm. They have no means of handling this. There's no immigrant tradition in Europe. Their own self-image as democratic is being tested, and the far right is leveraging this to win at the polls, especially in local elections. And the whole narrative of the far right is moving into the mainstream, and it needs to be challenged. And it's a narrative about a fictional past in Europe that is actually extremely dangerous.
We'll continue this in just a moment. More of tonight's Conversations with Great Minds with Max Blumenthal right after this break. And welcome back to Conversations with Great Minds. I'm speaking with journalist and writer Max Blumenthal, author of the new book, The 51-Day War, Ruin and Resistance in Gaza. Max, in an earlier book of yours, Republican Gomorrah, you argued that the Republican Party has thrown away their big tent philosophy and they're just basically going with this nativist base. And you quote in your book a letter from former President Eisenhower, Dwight Eisenhower, in which he said, "Dictatorial systems make one contribution to their people, which leads them to tend to support such systems: freedom from the necessity of informing themselves and making up their own minds concerning these tremendous, complex, and difficult questions." I mean, Eisenhower was talking about McCarthyism, but doesn't this describe the modern-day Republican Party? And in some ways, doesn't this also describe
U.S.-Israeli relations, at least at the level of policy discourse, which seems to have devolved to bumper sticker shouting matches?
Absolutely. Eisenhower was warning about the rise of the John Birch Society and about McCarthyism, was something he was trying to keep out of the party in order to maintain its national base. With the transfer of Southern Democrats and Dixiecrats into the Republican Party through Barry Goldwater in the 64 campaign, that marked the failure of Eisenhower, the end of the Eisenhower era, if you will. In my book, Republican Gomorrah, which I published at the dawn of the Obama era, when I warned that Obama would come under siege from far-right elements and that he would roll over in the name of post-partisanship, which was all borne itself out, and he would do massive damage to the progressive base. I tried to explain the kind of sensibility and the mentality of the people who comprise the Republican base, especially those in the Christian right. And so I drew on the work of Eric Fromm, who was a post-war psychologist. He wrote a book called Escape from Freedom, and the essence of his thesis was that if you fear freedom, if you can't stand alone in a very chaotic modern world, you will inevitably turn to fascism. Fromm identified the fascist follower, the proto-fascist, as a sadomasochist. And that doesn't mean, a sexual sadomasochist who's into kink, although some may be. What he was explaining was kind of a political sensibility in which the modern right-wing follower is sadistic in that they want to kick down the poor, the immigrants, those who are, Muslims, welfare queens, and they need these moral panics to generate the energy to do so. And at the same time, they're masochistic. They need to bow down to a higher authority, whether that's, the macho Jesus, Fabio from Nazareth, who populates so much of the modern literature of the Christian right, to, George W. Bush at his height, to some megachurch pastor. And through the fusion of sadism and masochism, they achieve a release from the inner crisis that they were experiencing in the modern world, and they absorb themselves into this political culture. It's that kind of sensibility that Fox News is constantly appealing to, right, with reports about how awesome whatever right-wing figure of the day they're propping up. Whether it's Phil Robertson from the Duck Dynasty, the martyr hero, victim hero, or Donald Trump or Sarah Palin, with images of black crime, Black Lives Matter being a radical threat, the sadomasochism is always present in right-wing media and in right-wing political culture. And right now, I think you've seen wedge issues drive Republican campaigns. 2004, it was same-sex marriage. During the 90s, it was abortion. Now it's about Muslims and immigration, particularly Muslim immigrants. And that Islamophobia has taken over the right-wing militia movement. It's leading to these massive rallies outside mosques in Arizona, where men carry carry automatic weapons along with protest signs that are just abominably racist. But it's also featured at the highest level when you can see it on CNN. They'll let Donald Trump speak at any event for 1 hour, unedited, unexpurgated, and it's just pure vitriol against immigrants. He's calling for removing all undocumented immigrants from the U.S. All of them. Imagine the kind of social catastrophe that will create, and it's also a plan that would cost $8 billion or more. But this is something that appeals, and it's something that Trump understands, even though he isn't from the Christian right. Even though he's just a businessman who could represent either party, but it's something that he understands, is that sadomasochistic sensibilities at the core of the Republican base, and this base, while they only make up maybe 12 to 15% of the American population, is absolutely frenetic. They're constantly listening to right-wing radio, Fox News, right-wing media. They're hammering the yard signs for the Republican candidates. They're running for school board elections. They're taking over local town councils. And so they have a disproportionate impact that moderate Republicans, to the extent that they exist anymore, don't have, or that the average suburban swing voter, the soccer mom, doesn't have, because they actually have lives. These people's lives consist of constant frenetic political activity in a very radical right-wing vein in order to quell their inner crises.
Right. John Dean, in his book Conservatives Without a Conscience, refers to these folks as authoritarians.
Well, Josh Duggar's the perfect example.
Yeah, and says that there's basically two kinds of authoritarians. There are, the vast majority of authoritarians are authoritarian followers, and then there's a small minority of authoritarians who are authoritarian leaders. And they can adapt themselves to pretty much any kind of political philosophy. That, you know, Joe Stalin was an authoritarian,
right,
quote, on the left, just like Mussolini was an authoritarian, quote, on the right. It doesn't matter. It's all authoritarianism.
Right.
How consequential is that a change in the Republican Party from the days of, you know, the 50s and 60s, the days of my dad's Republican Party, or maybe even before that? And how does that describe also the political nature of what's going on in Israel?
Well, the personal political sensibility of the right-wing authoritarian who is emblematic of the Republican base is crisis-afflicted. This is, as I said, Josh Duggar, the former head of the Family Research Council, which is the most powerful lobbying arm of the Christian right in Washington, who was spending time with a who's who of Republican presidential frontrunners until his sexual peccadilloes came to the fore, and really his hypocrisy came to the fore. It's a perfect example of what I'm talking about. He's a crisis-afflicted individual who's projecting his crises onto the Republican Party and altering the nature of the party itself, which, you know, is why we have people like Ted Cruz in the presidential race. It's also why Donald Trump is a front runner. So the party is irrevocably changed, and it will be unable to hold national power. It only holds power through gerrymandered congressional districts and through the, you know, the senatorial system.
And
their strategy is to prevent as many people from voting as possible. What does that say about the party? Just like Israel, the Republican Party is facing a demographic crisis, and it's aiming to, obviously, they can't ethnically cleanse, although that's what Trump is essentially calling for doing. So they're stripping people of voting rights, and they have this whole moral panic about voter fraud. But that's what it really comes down to, is the inability of the party to hold power at the national level. Looking forward, you can imagine Texas becoming a purple and then a blue state because of demographic changes. Even Mississippi, young people are increasingly voting Democratic. Mississippi will move out of the red column, possibly, you know, within the next 10 or 20 years. What's going to happen at the Republican National Convention if Trump holds strong? And the second, you know, figure is a surgeon named Ben Carson. He's not even a professional politician, and he's a right-wing fanatic as well. You could have a brokered convention where the Republican establishment tries to throw someone like Mitt Romney back into the ring. Romney's behind the scenes right now.
That's my prediction, actually.
And it's probably going to happen. Romney, the face of the Republican establishment, and the party will tear itself apart if this happens. So I think this all, the personal is political in the Republican Party. And when you have crisis-afflicted individuals projecting their psychology onto the party, the party itself can't go anywhere but towards a massive crisis. They're lucky they have no serious opposition from the other side.
Well, the Democratic Party is going through its own crisis too, is it not? And isn't some of that tied into it's an existential crisis, but it's more of a insider-outsider crisis. The party apparatchiks versus basically Bernie Sanders and the people that he represents.
Yeah, I mean, you can. I think, like, the media coverage of Hillary Clinton's been sort of unfair and ridiculous, but there's something deeper, and that's helped bring her numbers down, but there's something deeper there about what she really represents to the Democratic base. She represents the Clinton era, which was a time when the middle class was sold off, when NAFTA was passed, which has led to the immigration crisis, when the groundwork for the invasion of Iraq was laid, when the welfare system was destroyed.
The banks were deregulated.
We got rid of Glass-Steagall. So, you know, the Democratic base is very well informed. They're not the majority of Democratic voters, but we're talking about people who would self-identify as progressives. They're very well informed. They understood what the Clinton era meant for progressivism. The Obama administration has continued the process without interruption and filled its ranks with people like Rahm Emanuel, who's doing this at a local level in Chicago and facing massive opposition. And they're sick of it. You know, many of them have turned to the Sanders campaign, and I think it's unfortunate that Sanders can't make himself into a genuine anti-war candidate, because that would increase his cachet among progressives. But they're looking for some alternative to Clintonism, and they haven't been able to find it. And I think that's what the crisis that the Democratic Party faces that will play out at the convention, when Hillary Clinton will have to reinvent herself as some kind of new candidate. I don't know how she's going to be able to do so. So far, it's taken an apology tour from her husband, Bill Clinton, but that's not enough. I know she has some progressive instincts, at least on domestic policy, but she has to make those more clear. And for Bernie Sanders, I think his biggest problem right now is just name recognition.
And a virtual media blackout. I mean,
absolutely. And actually, Trump has played a huge part in that.
Yeah.
Trump is hogging all the media, and some of that should go to Sanders.
Yeah, I'm with you. Max, great having you with
thanks,
us. Thanks so much for being with us tonight. To see this and other Conversations with Great Minds, go to our website at conversationswithgreatminds.com. And that's The Big Picture tonight. Don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there, get active, tag, you're it.
That was journalist and author Max Blumenthal in conversation with progressive radio host Tom Hartman. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. We hope you will join us again next week, when we will feature Columbia University professor Rashad Khalidi in conversation with journalist Will Yeomans as they respond to allegations by the right-wing Zionist organization CAMRA concerning what they claim to be inaccurate interpretations from Ben-Gurion's diary concerning the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians. That is next Sunday on This Week in Palestine. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.